another interesting little story. Any event, they did go ahead and they did design the early dormitories, and they did the library, what they named at Melville after Melville's
Frank,
father.
Frank Melville.
Yeah, after Melville's father. We did the humanities at building. Fortunately, we surrounded the old library. It was such a bad building with a new building that is fairly good now, and we just ate it up, you know.
Right.
And we made major additions to the other things, but the other buildings are still there. You can still see them. I mean, make out what they were.
Why did you put the chemistry? Why did you put the science buildings, chemistry and biology, so close to the library, when the humanities, which are really the ones to use the library?
Well, the humanities was close to the library.
Well, it's
In the front, off the front plaza.
Yeah. It's much farther away than the chemistry, for instance.
Well, we were emphasizing the sciences at this particular campus at the time. I mean, when Rockefeller came in, his idea was that we were to build the Caltech of the East at the Stony Brook campus. I used to laugh at people and used to prove that they really didn't know much about what they were talking about, because I used to go around and say to people, whenever I'd hear this, I'd say, well, look at tell me, Caltech, you know Caltech? Oh, yes, they'd say, we know Caltech. I said, well, first I want to ask you a couple questions about Caltech. Is it a public or private college? Well, everybody would tell me it was a public university, so you mean public college. And I said, is it a college or a university? And they would say, well, it's a university. And then they'd say, is it public or private? And they would say, well, it's a public college. And I'd say, well, tell me, roughly, how big is it, you know? And holy cripes, I would get anything from 15 to 30,000, you know? And I said, well, I'll tell you, the last time I was there, which I did take a trip with a guy before, I mean, involving the whole programming of the Stony Brook campus out to California, I said that they were in a struggle at Caltech trying to determine if they could increase their student body by 10%. You know what 10% of their student body was? 60 students. They were trying to go from 600 to 660, and they were having a turmoil trying to do it. Well, it floored everybody, because they had to have no idea, you know what I mean, that Caltech was this kind of an institution. This is the kind of people we were dealing with here in the East.
Yeah.
So we did get the architecture started down there and building, and I don't think that we did it any faster with the fact that we had boys in there. We would have been much better, obviously, in my estimation, had we gone with the original intent of the thing. But we followed pretty much the master plan that Moore and Hutchins had developed. There's copies of that around. Of that master plan.
Okay.
Moore and Hutchins has them, in fact. There's some nice renderings of it. Then by this time, when we're underway, we finally, you know, come up to the point where you weren't going to do things through the old process of the old Department of Public Works, and all the rationale for creating the construction fund was there, and we worked in the central
office.
Essentially,
what was the rationale?
Well, what was happening is that it was obvious that the university was going to expand faster and bigger than... it was held down by the budget office and the Board of Regents for so long. Enrollments were curtailed, and the size and the way in which you had an opportunity to expand these places, it was dreadful of what you had to do. I mean, they wouldn't let you go out. And of course, you could do a master plan for Binghamton or Stony Brook, because they were plots of land, but these other campuses that are around in the cities and other places in Albany and so on, everybody expected you were going to expand. What the hell was there? And so you had no land acquisition policy. You had no plan on which you could do it in a logical, organized manner, because they wouldn't allow you to do it. So the need was to get things on a more professional, higher level. I mean, I remember I wrote many memorandums on this as to the need of doing master planning for the campuses rather than hodgepodge planning that we were doing, because we were picking up backyards of people's properties to build buildings on, and it didn't make sense. You know, nothing worked. Brockport was a great example for that. So anyway, the old Department of Division of Architecture of the Department of Public Works process just didn't work. And the other thing we were hamstrung with was the thing that this year they're trying to repeal, which is the Wicks Law. We had to go out in those days because of the law and everything with separate bids. I mean, for the primes and the generals and so on. And so we needed to get a few things changed if we were really going to do what you had to do in State University. And we wrote an autonomy bill for State University, and part of that autonomy bill that we had, we're working on that with Jack Crary and Charlie and Larry Murray, the group of us. Part of that autonomy bill was the autonomy for the capital construction program. And we had a lot of these things, single bid, and we had the need for master planning and speed in terms of do things, and the kind of demographic studies and things that we needed to do to make sense out of the whole thing. We slowly got the autonomy for State University. By autonomy, I meant that State University was still, in those days, operating with civil service personnel, and we had civil service librarians and registrars. I mean, important positions. It was very difficult.
They were treated just like another state department.
State department, yeah. Right. Yeah. It didn't have any kind of academic structure to it.
There was nobody who really understood what it was.
Well, they kept it under the thumb of the Board of Regents and the... In fact, I tell you, people herald, and rightfully so, Rockefeller with the great expansion of the State University. But when he first came into office, those of us in State University, we were already witnessed the moratorium that was put on things by Harriman. And then when we come into office, quite frankly, we were worried. And the worry was that Rockefeller had given every indication of supporting legislation that would enhance the private universities and colleges with state support in order to meet this particular demand, rather than see to it the State University was built. So for the first couple of years, we were very, very concerned. What year did Rockefeller come in? He came in 58, didn't he?
Yeah, I think I've got that here somewhere. What turned him around?
Frank Moore.
Frank?
That's right. He turned him around. Mm-hmm. Now, they're all dead now, so I can say anything I want, I guess, but that's how he got turned around, yeah. It wasn't Rockefeller that got hit by the bolt of lightning down in Pocanico Hills. It was Frank Moore, see, was already working for Rockefeller Foundation. Government. So he was a good friend. In fact, Frank Moore was one of the first influential ones to get Rockefeller to run for governor. And one of his first backers.
No, I don't have it. I don't. I do have it, but I gave it to Jerry.
We had these other setbacks with the moratorium of Harriman, and then...
Something did turn him around.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We put together quite a document for it wasn't as polished as I would like, but as good as we could do at the time, in which we indicated that what we needed was about $1 billion. I mean, in those days, in terms of the kind of expansion we were talking about, and not that our original idea of the bond issues maybe wasn't the thing, and it was, I don't know where the concept of the using the bonding thing, and that's when Mitchell finally comes in. I mean, he's later down the line of Mitchell. In fact, I went with Larry Murray at the very first meeting down in New York in Mitchell's office when he signed the first bonding program. He was as bad then as he is he was later. He was a cold fish, that guy.
He was what then?
He was the bond counsel. At the time,
I see.
For the
state?
No, for the bonding company that did the first bonding using the moral obligation bonds, the concept of the moral obligation bonds. Yeah, he was the bond counsel.
Okay.
Anyway, it came along that Frank Moore got Rockefeller to recognize the, as far as I'm concerned, the university. I remember Frank Moore came in and announced this one day that things were going to be different, and they were. And the next thing I knew, I was working with a guy by the name of Frank Willey, who was he was counsel to the Rockefeller. And in those days, Rockefeller had Ronan in his office, and George Dudley was
in
his
office. Did you see anything of Larry Walsh then, or had Larry Walsh left?
No, I didn't.
I knew him as assistant legal counsel under Dewey.
He'd long left.
Under Charlie Brightell.
He'd long left. Yeah, I remember the name, but he'd long left. Yeah, I came under Dewey when I first came in. What we did was take the original, that autonomy bill that we had developed, and we started using various segments of that, and that was I worked to write the technical aspects of the construction fund bill. That is, what we needed to accomplish technically in the construction, architectural, and so on. The financing arrangement of that bill and that whole side was, I think that was the Rockefeller's people and Frank Moore and the trustees and other people that they got involved. Because we had some pretty high-level people off of Wall Street on our trustees at the time, and came up with that particular concept of the funding. And of course, the bonding is what made it.
When did Norman Hurd come in?
Well, Norm Hurd was in for quite a while. Norm Hurd was he was an economics professor at Cornell before he ever came here, agriculture school. Yeah. And Norm was here, I think he was here under Dewey, and then he left for a while, and then he came back, and he was budget director, and then he went for a long, long time under Rockefeller, and then, of course, he went from budget director. Finally, he took Ronan's place when Ronan went down to, and Al Marshall. First it was Ronan, then it was Al Marshall, and he became the number two man under Rockefeller, Rockefeller's office. Norm Hurd took on that particular assignment. Norm's still around.
I'm going to see him.
Are you?
Yeah.
He's a wonderful to talk to.
He's a great guy.
I see him quite often, and I see him at SPAC all the time. I saw him just the other day, in fact, on the street.
He helped me with my chapter on agriculture of the Empire State at War that I wrote for under Dewey.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he's a very knowledgeable guy and would have a lot of input into all this stuff, yeah. Yeah, he'd be very good. Norm was always a good person to work.
He was an academic.
He understood more than some of the others.
Right.
But the scope, I think, until Rockefeller took it over, the scope of what the hell was necessary sort of was missed by an awful lot of people as to what the hell the university was. We got a hold of a lot of deaf ears. I mean, they couldn't visualize and couldn't understand the scope of what the hell was necessary to be done. And
I had the feeling that they were thinking in terms of the state rather than a national, an institution of national stature. And there was a relativism between within the state. We couldn't break out of a kind of a lockstep with Albany and Binghamton and Buffalo in any sense. Now, I may have been wrong, but that's the way I felt. And of course, when I came, Hamilton had already indicated that he would leave. That was a week after I got on the job.
Tom was a very very bright, very very capable guy. He had I think he did a lot for the university, but he had a tough road to hoe too.
Yeah.
While he was here, but he academically he knew what should be done and what had to be done. He had a very nice assistant that I liked very much, who later became a college president. He was a Rhodes Scholar that was here with it. Tom Allen. Well, anyways, taking back to Stony Brook, eventually, I just want to finish up the story about Voorhees office.
Okay.
When the construction fund finally came in 62, that was when you went there, right?
Right.
And the construction fund started. One of the early things that I indicated was that we had to do the master planning, which they took over, and we started all of that master planning business throughout the whole thing. But I was thoroughly disappointed and disgusted with what was happening at Stony Brook. And so the first thing we did was to get some additional firms on board to start some facilities that had to be from a size and from a design standpoint were a hell of a lot different than what we had there under Voorhees. Well, in any event, I guess to placate Voorhees' office, they felt under the construction fund that somehow I wanted to have everything ended with Voorhees' office. And they felt, well, under our direction, we can get Voorhees to do some decent stuff down there. So I said, I don't believe it. You're not going to change an office like that. Well, by God, they were going to change day into night as far as they were concerned. I mean, a lot of these early guys that were enthusiastic about this thing. They had a guy that went down to Voorhees' office, and he was going to teach them how to practice architecture, I guess. Well, good God, that was an old state office. I mean, they had a method of doing architecture and a style, and they, you know, nobody was going to change it. So they gave him the student union, an administration building that was to be on the campus down there. And things were happening awful fast. But one of the parts of the law. If you read the construction fund law, you'll find that in addition to the statement that the construction fund is within the State University of New York, the one saving grace that we had under the law, so I was university architect at that particular time, was that the university was responsible for approving the architectural concept. Well, most of the architectural firms that we had working in other places, I had given the names of the firms to, so that we could get that kind of a Ed Barnes, and we had already hired Ed Stone long before the fund came in to do the Albany campus, and we hired Skidmore, Owings & Merrill to do the Oswego campus. But it was that kind of a firm that we were looking for at these campuses to broaden ourselves out. And Voorhees' firm wasn't the kind of firm that we had in mind. So whoever the young fellow was that was in the construction fund at the time, again, I could, if time would, I could give you names because I can remember most of them. But he went to Voorhees' office and they turned out something. And they went right straight ahead and completed working drawings on these buildings, these two buildings, and advertised them for bid. Never even told
checking
us.
Checking with the construction.
No, never checking with the university.
University.
And so I let them know that, look, I was serious about the approval of the architectural concept, and they might as well find out early on that, you know, this was not the way to do things. I says, it may very well be turnout, but I says, you've got working drawings completed nobody's ever seen, and you've got these things now advertised for bid. So they brought the drawings in, and we were all under one roof up there at 194 Washington Avenue. Brought them in Tony's office in that particular time, Tony Adnoff, and laid them out. And they had
Tony
Adnoff, right. Yeah, who he and I got along pretty good. And George Dudley was there that day. He was one of the first trustees of the university, of the university construction fund.
Right.
And the kid that was doing the thing for the fund brought these in, and I remember Frank was there, William Frank Mansky. Anyway, they spread these out so that I could look at these buildings. And so I took one look at both of these working drawings now, complete, advertised for bid. And I thumbed through the drawings. It was the same old hat. It was the same thing. I'm in there. And I said, gentlemen, I thought that when we got started in this, that we were going to make a mark, and that, as I explained early on, we weren't responsible, and we certainly didn't want to repeat what the hell we had at these campuses that as we was going on at Stony Brook. I said, gentlemen, I want to tell you something. Even if it means my job, the architectural concept of these two buildings is disapproved. Well, some of those people that were there had only seen them the first time, too, you know.
Yeah.
They rolled up the drawings, paid off Voorhees Walker, his office. That was the end of Voorhees of ever doing anything in the state university again. And they hired a conglomerate firm in those days of DeMaz, Bocconi, and Weigel to do the administration in the student union building. And so these sort of things that happen. When I say the appointment of Lee, getting started under the, you know, at the all the way back to the science and for teachers, you know, for science teachers, and getting Lee and involved, and poor Len Olson, and I mean, all these were disasters, or kind of broomhangles between people's feet. Well, anyway, then we got started architecturally with the thing, and the way in which we're going down there today. So it was a sure shaky early start, no question about it. There's a whole lot of other interesting side stories I could give you, but the time probably won't ever permit.
Well, of course, I've got all the time in the world. I noticed as things were going up.
Now, we bought the site for the medical college. Given to us.
Let me. I know damn well you did.
Yeah. I insist that we get that site across the way.
Well,
we needed that bad.
You know, one day, I knew Bayless Manus. And one day he said, you know, I was concerned about land because looking 20, 50 years down the road, you needed more land than you had.
Absolutely.
And Levitt had just taken the land to the south.
That's right, that big tract down through there.
You better get the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
because that was the site that had the water tower on it. And Bayless Manus was on the water board.
Yeah. And Bayless said, you know, you better get those 150 acres that was to the east of Nickel Road, pretty soon before somebody else.
St. George's Country Club was just down below us.
Yeah, right.
We had our eye on that.
So I went back and called, and I was dealing with Herb Gordon at the time.
Yeah, he worked for me.
Well, I told him about my conversation with Bayless Manoos, and I said, you better get it soon. And he said, well, you know, we're running into difficulty with the trustees. They seem to say, we're not in the land bank business. And, somehow it worked out all right. Every now and then the people in the golf course would say, well, look, does the State University want to buy that?
I went to the trustees on that land.
Did you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
On which land? You mean
on that land for the medical.
You could.
Oh, absolutely. Good. And also, we bought land outside up there where the Surge parking lots are. We bought that land, too. And where we built the Surge buildings, we bought that land. That wasn't part of the original.
I know.
I remember very well. And then there was a piece of property that finally went down and went down to, what's the name of that road down there? Pond Path Road.
Pond Path.
Yeah, we bought that.
We
bought that and the possibility of having a extra way out, you know what I mean?
Right.
We were looking for other exits to go along there. Yeah.
I walked all over that.
Yeah.
And
Pond Path Road.
Then where you've got your great big parking lots to the south, you get Stony Brook Road and Oxhead Road.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've just been out to Michigan State. Michigan State has 18,000 acres.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, of course, it's an agricultural technical as well as a general. So, and here you had Johns Hopkins with less than 100 acres in the middle of Baltimore. And it didn't seem to me that while the land was there...
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that was recognized early in planning that we needed that particular property. And we have none too much even today in terms of what the hell we're trying to do down there. I think we're all right, but, I mean, we have none too much.
You have some room to move yet.
Yeah.
Okay. We're almost through with this particular tape. I noticed that... If you take laboratories, lecture halls, or lecture rooms, and offices, on the campus, there are at least three different ways of handling the relationships among rooms. The old humanities building, the classrooms are all in the middle, and the offices are on either side. You don't have any lecture hall. Well, you had one lecture hall at the end.
And we had a lecture hall in each one of the original science buildings.
And then in those buildings, you had laboratories on one
side,
classrooms
on
the other.
Yeah.
And then you have...
That wasn't much different than the original laboratory, science buildings we used to do for the science building number ones, we call them. In fact, that's how Oscar Langford got associated. I mean, see, Oscar was a dean at Albany early on, and... When Sputnik went up, everybody got excited, and this is before the fun night. This is 1958. When was Sputnik?
57.
Anyway, everybody got excited. And the next year's budget, we had six or seven science buildings in the budget for various colleges. They're all teachers' colleges at that particular time. Well, you didn't have any people in science at the colleges that could tell you what even the program needed to be. So Oscar, who was a chemist and was provost then at Albany under F. Collins, right across the street from where we were on Thurlow Terrace at the time, I got to know Oscar through his involvement with the Atmospheric Research Center with Schaefer. Oscar was one of the founders of the Atmospheric Sciences Research Center. Not many people know that. Yeah. But anyway...
But he was also president of Fredonia.
Well, that's how he became... I'm telling you how he became president of Fredonia. Oscar, I went to Larry Murray, and I said, Larry, we haven't got anybody in these colleges, and we've got to... that knows anything about these science facilities. I said, we've got to have somebody that's going to do a program for us of a general nature so that these buildings can become... They're going to be maybe one of two or three science buildings a lot of these colleges are going to have. And... I says, you know, we can design something, but we got to know what the hell is designed. So Oscar wrote the original, together with our particular office, Oscar was our consultant, writing a general purpose science facility that we could build at these campuses. And it's pretty much the same program at all the campuses around there. Well, then through his particular activities in relationship with Larry Murray, when Harry Porter came to the central office as the provost in the central office early on, the opening came at Fredonia. And so Larry and
was
I
Harry
got talking.
Was president of Fredonia?
Oh, yeah, he was president of Fredonia.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
And so we got talking one day, and I said, hey, why don't you throw Oscars? I said, he would be a damn good college president, I think. I said, he's been great to work with on this thing. And Larry, by the time we contacted, we knew a lot of people in those days. Everybody was a kind of a close-knit family.
Right.
And
yeah.
Some people on the local council out there. And next thing we know, Oscar was appointed as president of Fredonia. So my association with Oscar goes back years. Of course, fortunately, he came in here, you know, after that, after his stint there. So it goes back a long ways.
Well, look, I've taken up enough of your time, at least this time.
Well, it's kind of fun to reminisce about it.
It certainly is.
It's, as I say, it's